On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Britain has voted to leave the European Union, sending global financial markets into chaos. The move was spurred in part by dissatisfaction with remote, unaccountable European government institutions in Brussels, and it was also a reaction against immigration. Today we'll talk about why it happened and what it means for the United States. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Margie O'Meara, a Democratic pollster and executive vice president at PSB Research. Our special guest is Gene Sperling. He was the director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. He's also been advising Hillary Clinton. Welcome to you all. So this Brexit vote was a shock, although maybe it shouldn't have been. Lots of polls in the month leading up to the vote showed Leave ahead of Remain, and even though polls in the last week showed a shift towards staying in the EU, the final polls were close to a tie. So we should have been prepared for the idea that Leave might win, but we weren't, and neither were stock and currency markets worldwide, which have been in severe turmoil as we tape on Friday. The falling pound, down about 10% on Friday, means real incomes in Britain are already lower as a result of this vote. Gasoline and other traded goods will get instantly more expensive in the UK. British homebuilder stocks were down about 30% on Friday because fewer people in Britain are likely to be able to afford to buy homes because of this. So, Rich, you were for Brexit. Am I wrong to look at the sharp decline in stock prices all over the world and the sharp decline in the British pound as indicators that this move will hurt the economy and make people poorer around the world and especially in Britain?
Well, first of all, I think there's just a foundational question of whether Britain's going to govern itself and whether Parliament will be the supreme lawmaking authority in Britain or not. And it seems to me, if you're a British person, the answer to that should be yes, of course Parliament should make our own laws. And I think the turmoil in the markets, a lot of it is a reaction to the shock of this thing passing when a lot of people, as you pointed out, convinced themselves that it wouldn't. A lot of it is a reaction to the scaremongering of the Remain side. And the idea that Britain is going to sink beneath the waves, the fifth largest economy in the world, unless it subsumes some significant amount of its sovereignty in the EU, which has suffered anemic economic growth recently, I think is just absurd. I think we'll find a new equilibrium across, you know, sort of all these areas. And the FTSE 100, for what it's worth, is actually up from the beginning of the week to the end of the week. So some of the pound gained a little bit by the end of the day. So I think it would be a mistake to draw broad economic make dire economic assumptions about what's going to happen based on the first day.
Gene, what do you make of that? Is this as bad as the markets are making it look today, or is Rich right to be pretty sanguine about this?
Oh, no, I don't think we should be sanguine at all. I mean, you know, it's like an earthquake. You know, there's the shock, there's the aftershocks, there's the potential contagion. So, you know, I do agree you can't make all this judgment in a single day. But, you know, whether we like it or not, we all are connected. It's no, you know, when a major economy sneezes, you know, many of us get a cold. We've seen that even when there's been problems with Greece. So now you have the UK, you know, one of the largest economies in the world, do this self-inflicted wound that is going to create enormous uncertainty. It creates very difficult problems. You know, they export 44% to the rest of Europe. They now, it's going to be impossible, I think, for the EU to say, of course, you're going to get all the benefits, but then you're going to respond to the anti-immigration views by not having to take the free movement of people. And so when you saw Cameron resign. I thought I stayed up for that. That was a rather bold and striking moment. But you could also see behind it, okay, you've created this mess. Here are the keys. You now have to take on this very messy negotiation. And you also see that the collateral damage, a lot of the markets getting hurt the worst are in the weaker European countries where there's more uncertainty. There's going to be more what I think people are already calling exit contagion. So to bring more volatility, more uncertainty into the global economy right now and have the UK in the situation for the next probably 2 years of conflict, uncertainty, where, as I think Cameron and the Remain party rightly said, they are not going to, it's just the opposite of Rich said, they're going to have less control over their destiny because they're so integrated with Europe. And now major decisions about their economy are going to be made without them at the table. And I think that you're going to see some exit of businesses, exit of investment, and exit of jobs from the UK. I'm not saying it's going to sink them. Responsible people are working together. You saw a responsible, you know, global economic leaders come forward to try to stabilize the situation. But is the UK going to be poorer and worse off because of this? You know, most certainly.
Margie, were you surprised by this result? I feel like it's part of a pattern of things that elites really didn't want to happen and therefore convinced themselves weren't going to happen. You have this, you have Donald Trump's nomination in the United States. I'd also put the failure of comprehensive immigration reform to pass in this box that for years we've been saying, you know, well, immigration reform is really popular. We poll it and people say they want it, and yet election results don't push in that direction. Is this something that we should have seen coming, and how much of it is the fault of pollsters?
Well, I'm definitely not going to blame pollsters. I mean, look, the polling showed that Remain had the advantage for a long time. And then in the last few weeks, the polls started tightened. They got very volatile, and it was basically neck and neck. Some polls showed a slight advantage for Leave. Some showed a slight advantage for Remain. The average was tied. The predictive markets, which at times can be quite good at actually predicting the outcome, were more optimistic that Remain would prevail. And I think there you saw, just as you note, some magical thinking. And I think there was some magical thinking during the Republican primary, where people thought initially when they saw Trump doing well, people thought, well, folks are lying to pollsters. They must be lying to pollsters because they think it's funny to answer, yes, I'm for Donald Trump. And that was a theory for like a few months that people, I think, were just hoping would be true. Even up until the very end, people were hoping that it would just somehow simply go away. So I think there was a little bit of that going on this time. And as a result, I think also people were sort of, rooting for polling to be wrong, or expecting a polling crisis and looking for pollsters to be the scapegoat here. I don't think it should be a surprise about this outcome. The outcome was actually quite, you know, fairly close, and it was fairly close in the polls.
So I think this is part of a broader trend that we're seeing all over the world of rejections of institutions, rejections of experts. You had Michael Gove, one of the leading conservative politicians in the UK, responding to all the economic warnings about Brexit by saying that people are sick and tired of experts telling them what to do. And I don't love this trend, although it does reflect in part significant failure by experts, especially economic experts, over the last decade. We did have this giant global financial crisis that nobody seemed to expect or figure out how to plan for. And so I guess one of the key questions facing Britain and the world is how to deal with the failure of experts and the failure of elite institutions without acting in an essentially random manner and replacing those experts and those elites with something worse. And I know, Rich, you've watched your own Republican Party respond to, in some cases, quite reasonable grievances that people have had in a totally unreasonable way by nominating Donald Trump. So when you look at these changes, what do you think needs to be done to ensure that appropriate dissatisfaction gets channeled in a productive direction?
Well, I mean, first of all, you should be able to hold your experts accountable and throw them out of office if you want. And that is not the case with the EU. It's the case with David Cameron. He'll be gone by October, but no one's going to fire, and Britain gets to fire the head of the European Commission. And I support free trade. I think it's very, it's welcome that that the EU has pushed Europe in that direction. I hope Britain can forge a free trade agreement going forward with the EU or with the constituent countries in it. But we have free trade with Mexico and Canada without giving up any of our sovereignty to a pan-American superstate. And a superstate in Europe that doesn't have a very good record. This goes back to your question about experts, Josh. I mean, they gave us the euro, which has been a bit of a disaster and is immiserating Greece as we speak. It gave us, Angela Merkel, who gets at her whim to welcome a million refugees into Germany and draw more refugees into the continent and to try to use the EU to force down the throats of other EU states, these refugees as well. And I think it's entirely understandable, appropriate, and correct for Britain to say, no, we're not going to be a part of that. We may make mistakes. We may have experts we hate and want to get rid of, but they are going to be our experts accountable to us. That is just a basic part of being a nation state.
Just a quick thing. There was a poll recently in the run-up to the vote, and folks who were for Remain were more trusting of experts generally, not just on this, on as a group, than folks who wanted to leave. There is something about just trust in experts. Who do you trust people to give you good advice, or do you feel that really no one can provide you good advice? You might as well just ask the next person you see on the street, and that's a real dividing line that I think you saw in this vote.
The thing I find remarkable about what Rich had to say is I agree that the Eurozone has been a disaster, but Britain's not in the Euro. They've been able to take most of the good parts of the EU while rejecting the worst parts, and they also have their own passport controls. So while they have to accept free movement of other EU citizens into Britain, they don't have the problem of people basically walking onto Great Britain from the European continent. So these seem like objections that would make more sense voiced from anywhere else in Europe than from Britain. And I'm wondering, Gene, because you were in the Clinton administration at the time that the euro was being hatched, and obviously the U.S. isn't a party to it, but it was, a matter of economic concern, something we knew would affect us. Was there a sense at the time that this was likely to lead to significant problems, that you would have countries that had a currency that was not flexible enough for them and that it would create ongoing economic chaos in Europe?
I always felt that most of the skepticism was more towards the euro than the EU. That issue of countries being able to modulate their fiscal and macroeconomic policies to hit the business cycle when you had a single currency, there were always people who raised those objections against the benefits of having a single currency. But as you said, the UK seems in many ways, I agree with what you said, in the position where they were probably getting the most benefit at the least cost. And I really think that what you're seeing is, and I think what's important, and I think it plays into what we're seeing in the United States, is there is legitimate unhappiness among working families in many of the advanced countries in the world, including the United States, and for legitimate reasons, which is that there's been remarkable globalization, technology change, financialization, and yet there is very little confidence that these changes are benefiting middle classes. There's much more of a sense that they're hollowing out than strengthening middle classes. And it really creates a critical moment. What do you do with that unhappiness and resentment? Now, my view is whether you support the kind of policies I support or Hillary Clinton supports or a different set of policies, that you want an optimistic and positive way of saying, here's how we're going to raise middle class, here's how we're going to work together to solve those issues. I would have a different agenda than a Republican, a traditional Republican candidate might. But I think you also see the darker side, which is people use this resentment to divide, to make somebody the enemy. In particular, people who are immigrants or are not like you. And I think that what I find distressing and what I hope the UK can overcome is the sense that they were looking for that scapegoat. And that's where I think this election becomes very important here. It's not just about, I think, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, but I think it's what Donald Trump represents versus even the other Republican candidates who ran, which is a real politics of saying, I see the anger, I see the resentment, and I'm going to push people towards their worse angels, not their better angels. And I think you see this playing out, and I think it's going to be the most important thing for whoever is in the governing leadership to be able to have a positive, affirmative, bringing people together agenda, as opposed to one that takes advantage of that resentment to divide. And you certainly saw some of that message coming through in the Leave campaign.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back talking more about this. But let us know what you think about Brexit at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24, programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Margie O'Meara, Democratic pollster and executive vice president at PSB Research. Gene Sperling, top economic advisor to Presidents Clinton and Obama, is also with us. So, Margie, I want to ask you about something Gene touched on before the break, which is basically the parallel in the politics of resentment that we saw in the Leave campaign and that we've seen with Donald Trump's campaign. A lot of people in the U.S. are looking at this and wondering what it means for U.S. politics. Is this a sign that we should take the prospect of a Donald Trump victory more seriously? What do you see as the links and any differences between what we observed in Britain and what we're likely to see in the U.S.?
Well, there are some similarities and also some clear differences. I don't think a vote for Leave is a vote for incompetence the way it is for Trump. I mean, Trump is so unqualified to be president, in addition to all his other flaws in terms of the language that he uses. You don't have that dynamic in Leave, I don't think, in Brexit. I do, however, see very much this, you know, similar dissatisfaction with institutions, dissatisfaction with government, feeling that things have gone so adrift that really anything may be, any kind of change may be a good change. I also, though, regardless of what happened in Brexit, very much fear that Trump can win. I don't think I would point to Brexit as a proof point one way or the other about what it means for Trump's ability to win in the United States. I mean, he has been close to tied in the polls for a while. I mean, obviously they bounce around a little bit, and sometimes he's up, sometimes he's down. Otherwise, his fundraising numbers are terrible, and his favorables are terrible. He is, you know, not that far off from Hillary Clinton in a lot of national polls. So the odds of him being successful are certainly not zero. So I'm worried, regardless. Even if Remain had won by a large margin, I'd still be concerned.
So one parallel I see between the two is the power of immigration politics in both places, and the power of an immigration issue that elites on both sides of the aisle in Britain and in the U.S. had been reluctant to take up. There's clearly a big market for a more restrictive immigration policy than either country has that was underserved. And I just wonder that this has come to be animated in the United States in the form of Donald Trump, who wraps it in all this racism and in a way that embarrasses, I think, a lot of people on the right who would like to agree with him on these issues. And I guess the question is there room for a more restrictionist immigration politics that is not shot through with racial appeals, given that it seems like for a lot of voters, the reason they have a problem with immigration isn't really about national culture or about the economy and the job market. It's just about wanting to be surrounded by people like them.
Well, I think obviously, it's possible. If Ted Cruz would be the nominee, that's exactly what we would be hearing, is a restrictionist case sort of shorn of the absurdities that Donald Trump engages in routinely. But you know, everyone is now looks at Brexit and they want to say, oh, Trump's going to win. But the difference is, as we've just discussed, Brexit was a referendum. It's not a person running to be the head of state. So if Nigel Farage becomes the prime minister of Britain, which he won't, maybe that's analogous to Donald Trump becoming president of the United States.
Nigel Farage is the leader of the UK Independence Party, a far-right political party in the UK that's been a strong supporter of Brexit.
But it does go to the power that nationalism has. People feel a natural affinity and identity with their country. And I just don't buy the idea that the Leave campaign was this cynical race-baiting thing. It was the root of it was that Britain should govern itself, and that's an admirable thing. Europe is not a country, and Poles emigrating to Britain is not the same thing as people from Tennessee moving to Texas. And Britain should get to decide whether or how many Poles come into the country every year. And it had given away that power to the EU.
Gene, Hillary Clinton has staked out a position on immigration that's significantly to the left of the existing policy of the Obama administration. Has taken a stance that basically she wouldn't deport adults or children who had arrived in 2013 or earlier who are not criminals. That's much bigger than the set of people who would have been protected from deportation by the executive order that President Obama had tried to issue that the Supreme Court was unable to reach a ruling on this week. Isn't there a concern that that's basically moved too far to the left? It's something of a backdoor open border policy that so long as people get here early enough, legally or illegally, they get to stay. Shouldn't we be somewhere in between where she is and where Donald Trump is on this issue?
I don't see it that way. I think that you've seen President Obama, and I think you'd see Hillary Clinton having a very tough policy at the border to make sure there's not new illegal immigration. But I think it comes with how do we deal with people who are here, real-life families, real-life people. I mean, it's heartbreaking to think what happened with the Supreme Court yesterday. It's heartening to think that it could be different with a new Supreme Court justice or a new president. But think about that. Those were parents who've been here over 5 years, who had not committed any type of crime, who have legal children in the United States. What are you talking about when you talk about being against this? You're talking about being willing to rip families apart? And I really do believe that, I'll give a point of optimism. I think if Hillary Clinton wins this presidential election, I think you could see a real chance of some form of immigration reform. Because I think that even beyond the fact that people like myself support it for humanitarian reasons, and we think it's right economically, that it will be, and the Congressional Budget Office confirms that it will lead to more workers, people being able to move more, buy more houses, do things because they're legal. But beyond that, I think on the Republican side, is this really a Democrat-Republican divide? The last two Republican presidents are closer to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama than they are to Donald Trump. I think there's no question that Paul Ryan, in his heart, would like to see this. Marco Rubio worked hard on immigration reform. So I think that, politics could play a positive role here, because I think if Hillary Clinton does win, I think that many in the Republican leadership will say enough. If we alienate ourselves so much by being so against what matters so much to Latino Americans here in our country, that we're going to lose touch, because our country is a diverse country, and to run against that diversity and be against that is going to fundamentally hurt oneself. So I think this is I have a little bit of optimism that if Hillary Clinton can prevail, that this consensus that you could actually see from the last presidents, Democrat and Republican, the last four presidents, could finally get into Washington, and perhaps we could see some form of common sense immigration reform.
But I think what you just described sort of goes to my point, which is the existence of an elite consensus involving a lot of people on the right and the left that's pretty friendly to immigration that is not necessarily reflective of where a lot of the public is. And I think that's true both here and in the UK.
What I was referring to, though, on the Republican side was not just about elite consensus. It's about the fact that Latino Americans are Americans. They're fellow citizens. They're people who desire to be citizens who are here, and they are alienating rank and file workers, voters, people who have a relative who's affected by these things. So I think this is different, Josh, because I think what could finally move some of the Republican leadership is not the elitism, or not that maybe Paul Ryan understands why this is good for growth, but that he understands that they're going to lose a strong portion of Americans. And again, I think we have to try to, you know, do this together in a way that will work for everyone, that still leaves, you know, a path for citizenship. But I actually think that it's going to be more grassroots politics and somewhat vote counting on the Republican side that's going to make them realize that they are very unlikely to take control of the White House if they continue to alienate more and more a part of our country that's actually becoming a larger and larger portion of the voting public.
And the polling backs Gene up. I mean, sometimes it can be sensitive to question wording. So one poll, this is ABC Washington Post, should undocumented immigrants be allowed to stay or deported? And if you have it in that frame, it's almost divided, although a majority say allowed to stay. When Pew asks a similar question, but says, should undocumented folks have certain requirements they need to meet in order to stay? It doesn't even specify what the requirements are. There you have 3/4 say allowed to stay. So we can get there. The consensus is there if you use a phrase as simple as requirements. Like this is, you know, we're talking about having a set of laws and requirements, and, you know, let's have a discussion about what those are. But as long as there are some and we have some kind of policy, then you can get a lot of people on board.
Well, yeah, people do like the idea of requirements, which is why in these comprehensive immigration reforms, they always include requirements in the as a sweetener in the amnesty. But the requirements are almost completely meaningless. You know, the illegal immigrants are supposed to pay back taxes when no one knows how much they earned while they were here. And even if we did, they are likely so poor that they wouldn't owe taxes and, in fact, would be eligible for the earned income tax credit. And the idea that if we have fewer illegal immigrants in this country, the nation will no longer be diverse is completely absurd. And the economic case for low-skilled immigration in particular is very weak. There is some net benefit, a small net benefit to GDP. It comes at the cost of lower-skilled workers whose wages are suppressed, and it doesn't account for the fiscal costs of paying for the schools, of children of illegal immigrants, paying for their health care, et cetera. So we need to control our border. We need to take care of this problem by having an enforcement system that actually works, and only then should we be having a discussion about what we do with the remaining illegal immigrants.
Rich misstated the issue, though. I think we all agree on the border control, on not allowing a wave of new illegal immigrants to come in. But the issue we're dealing with is 11 million people who are already here. And when independent sources like the Congressional Budget Office look, they say you'll have almost a trillion dollars more in revenues because they'll be able to come out of the shadows and pay taxes. So these are people who are already here. And if they're not illegal, if they're legal, they'll be able to bargain more for their look out for themselves. Therefore, this is one of the reasons I think organized labor is now supporting this, because they realize they're already here. And if they can come out of the shadows, they will be taken advantage of less, and that will put less downward pressure on wages. So the real issue is, what are we doing with 11 million real live mom and dads, brothers and sisters, children that are here in our country right now that want to work? And that's the real issue that is dividing us and should bring us together. I think we can all agree that nobody is advocating for a new wave of illegal immigration or getting soft on the border. Nobody, not Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, is for that.
You effectively are, if you're not going to enforce the laws in the interior, which President Obama hasn't done. And the indications are that new illegal arrivals are tipping up again. Is President Obama really exercised about that? Are you exercised about that? I really doubt it.
Unfortunately, I have to cut off there. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Margie O'Meara, and Gene Sperling. Laura Dine Million and Hannah Tayson produced today's program. Our technical director is Phil Richards. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Let's go.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.